It's May 12th, 2024, and welcome to episode 275 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now. And my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know. Will I ever find my way back to us?
Will I ever... The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, floods, and 1975, I guess. I'm Paul, near Boston, and I am joined today by three retro computing enthusiasts. We have Quinn Dunkey from rural British Columbia. How are you?
Hello, that is my name and my location approximately. I'm doing very well. It's very hot and dry here. We're having a heat wave. So apparently Michael got all the rain that we used to have.
Right. Also joining us for the first time in a while, Michael Mulhern in Sydney. How are you?
Soggy. Damp. And for those that don't like the word, moist.
Thanks.
Demonetized.
So yeah, I'll just put my background in context. The creek behind me is at the back of my property. It's normally not even knee high, and you can jump across it. It's now currently about upper chest high, and I definitely can't jump across about 20 meters. So there's been it has broken its banks. And the one of my road accesses is currently underwater, so I've got to leave the area the long way. Yeah, the causeway is currently under about a meter of water.
And also joining us, Blake Patterson from the DC area. How are you?
I'm doing well. The moist is the word around here, or has been for the past 2 months or so, with the flooding of my my basement computer room, the moniker for the Byte Cellar website I run. We had a failed sump pump, and the carpet got very much with that word, and we had to empty everything. I had to empty everything in this room and do a number
we
of things.
Sense of
and then, yeah, and so it's actually being set up, back set up. I think no hardware was damaged, but it continues to be quite an experience, and as a public service, I'd recommend everyone have their sump pump replaced every 5 to 6 years. I would say, embarrassingly, I do admit, apparently I waited 20 years, which is too long.
Wow.
So that's the list. The batteries, capacitors, and sump pump. Take care of all
yes,
of these things.
Just don't get them confused and take out the sump pump.
Yes.
Right.
Indeed. So yes, I'm busy today. I've busied myself with further resetting up things in the background. For those on the YouTube stream, you can see a partially assembled Amiga 2000. I'm trying to bring that on today. So
nice.
Get it online by tonight. We'll see. Anyway, all right. That's it for me. Yeah.
Cultural question. Are sump pumps like an Eastern American thing? Like, I've heard of them. I'm sort of aware of what they are, but like houses here don't have them as far as I know.
Well, yeah, I'll say the where I live in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and certainly all of the homes in the region close to where I am, if there's a basement, there typically is a sump pump, which, you know, you have your basement, you can have basement leaks, cracks coming in, little water coming in through minor cracks in the wall. It's always through the wall. What can be done is a sort of a trench is dug into the concrete, into the floor, into the foundation. Rocks are put in. There's a channel, and it leads to, it's a connected channel. It covers the perimeter of the room typically, and it leads to, in one of the corners, a, a kind of a large bucket in which there is about a 12-inch tall, very hopefully rugged pump with a floater. And when water drains down through the block wall very slowly, it accumulates, ends up in that bucket, and it kicks on. And, that's a very common and fairly reliable. I can't fault the 20-year-old pump that failed on me. I should have replaced it. But it's extremely common here. And I think I've noticed in building single family homes, especially Northern Virginia, where they're are getting quite large with the economic situation up here, they've opted more and more to build a three-story house and dispense with the basement to kind of avoid that issue, because water is a big issue, right?
Yeah, I think the difference in basement wall composition is probably the difference. So, like, we certainly have houses here in wet areas as well, but we do drainage differently. Like, we use French drains on the outside of the foundation wall, and the foundation wall is sealed with a rubber membrane and on the outside. Mm-hmm. And there's various other different ways it's done. But I guess in the eastern U.S. where it's wet, you have a lot of older houses with, like, block wall foundations and things where they're not really totally watertight. So that makes sense.
I will say, just to add briefly and make it a bizarrely long and unrelated introduction.
Yeah, sorry, I've just ruined this podcast.
Had a very, very moist garage turned into a kind of a rec room, work room. And the way that was done was, indeed, a French drain was put outside. The outside wall was waterproofed as best can be done. And there's a pump. I guess we've been, and then there's at the end of that French drain, just to make sure, and we're calling that a sump pump, but it's outside. So
Now folks in the comments are chiming in with various other places where they do sometimes have them, and I think the common thread is probably the age of the house more than the location of the house. I think older houses, they built foundations less watertight than they do nowadays, is probably why, because I've mostly lived in the West where the houses are mostly quite new, so they have newer standards for building basement walls. But anyway, that was fascinating for me, at least, because I like this stuff. So all right, Paul, what's next on retro home maintenance roundtable?
Well, yes, this week's plumbing hints are from 1975.
Yep. So exactly. So we're doing episode 275, and we've been generally tracking the years with these episodes. And the year that would correspond to is 1975. So we were going to just talk about at least a little bit about some things that happened in 1975. It sort of seems like, as usual, in the last couple of years, it's like not a lot has happened, but it's just about to become like impossible to talk about these things. So I think this might be the last one where there's like not a lot to talk about. And I don't know what we're going to do for 276.
I thought 75 was the year of the Altair on the cover of Radio Electronics magazine. Is that?
Yeah. Okay. That is it. So
that's the big one. Okay.
That is the big one. Yeah. So I guess we can talk about that. I'll put the Wikipedia article up. So I guess as I understand the story, Popular Electronics was going to do a, story about the Altair 8800, and they were going to do a cover shoot of the machine, and it got lost somewhere in transit. Like there was one of them, and they sent it there, and it didn't make it. So they actually did have, in the January 1975 issue, the cover said the Altair 8800, but it was in fact not an 8800. It was some sort of mock-up in order to just have something on the cover. So it doesn't actually look anything like it.
That's amazing. I actually didn't know that factoid.
So that's why the cover looks, unlike what you think of when you think of an Altair 8800,
Yeah, I guess I just assumed that was like a prototype or something, and that's why it looked different. That's funny that it was just actually a fake thing that they did. Put together.
This issue is sought after, people will spend a lot to get one of these. And actually it does. I just learned yesterday that the article about it continues in the second issue too. So this is only part one.
But is it, I was always under the impression that the magazine actually had schematics so that you could build one in it. Cause that was what, Popular Electronics often had projects in the magazine that you could build. Is that the case or no?
I know that I do not know. I know you could order the kit through them.
Okay. Well, it's like not necessarily a kit, but like they would publish the schematics of things. Similar to what we do nowadays, where like You go on a YouTube channel and they'll have a project and they'll give you the plans, but they'll also sell you a kit if you want to have an easier time of building the thing.
I wasn't aware of that. There was similar vintage machines in the Australian magazines, the Super 80 and a few others that were schematic supplied, list of materials, and also then available as a kit for those that didn't want to etch their own PCBs. Oh, those were fun days.
You know, so this issue came out in, it was the January 1975 issue, and that also, I mean, I don't know if we want to keep talking about the Altair 8800, but one aspect of this is that Bill Gates and Paul Allen got it, read it, thought it was interesting, thought, hey, you know, we should write a BASIC for this, and immediately turned around and wrote one. So, like, that was the beginning of Microsoft as well. I think they established, when did they establish? April or something? I mean, it was sometime really, like, astoundingly fast after they'd heard of this computer. But, you know, they wrote Altair BASIC and released it. Sold it to Altair, to MITS, I think.
There's a significant chunk of I'm sure we've all seen Pirates of Silicon Valley, the Apple history, Microsoft history film from some years ago. It's of course abbreviated and dramatic, but show Bill Gates seeing the magazine cover, and then they quickly put together BASIC, and Paul Allen flies down there. It's interesting, and it seems to capture what generally did seem to happen. And they were conveying that indeed it kicked off, you know, Microsoft. It seemed like such an opportunity. So I'd also recommend that movie. It's really good. I think of all the Apple history movies, Silicon Valley history movies, it oddly perhaps is, in my opinion, by far the best.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember thinking positive thoughts in its direction.
Yeah, I think it was pretty low budget. I can't remember who put it together. It was, I think, one of the, you know, cable networks. But I think it outshined some of the, you know, the much, much larger productions. But anyway, I watch that about every year and a half. I still enjoy it.
Part of the Microsoft lore story is that they, I think if I remember this right, that they showed up but didn't have a loader.
Yeah.
So they had to write that in the hotel, you know, before the meeting. So they had the tape, but they couldn't get it off the tape onto the demo.
I mean, Bill Gates was sort of known for that in the early days of making deals that he wasn't necessarily sure he was ready for yet. Like, they did the same thing with DOS, right? They made a deal with IBM to write this DOS. I think he actually told them they had it already. And then he got them to sign the deal. And then they very quickly wrote it after they got the deal that had been signed on the premise that they already had it. He did a lot of stuff like that in the days.
Well, I think, in fact, they bought it, right? I mean,
That's right. They didn't even write it. That's right.
It's QDOS or something like that.
Yeah, they bought it from some guy who'd... Yeah, that's right.
I'd hate to be that guy.
Yeah, does seem likely that that guy got the short end of the stick.
I guess the Bill Gates, those few business decisions, a bit bold, were well chosen, I suppose.
Yeah.
It always makes me kind of respect Jack Tramiel more when we talk about these stories, because he's sort of the only guy that ever got one over on Bill. He's the only guy that managed to get BASIC without a license. Which is also why they never updated it in Commodores, and I think MITS was too, right? Like, MITS was a one-time deal, and it was, if I remember this correctly, it was from this deal that Bill decided he was never again going to just sell it. He was always going to license things, because that's where the money is. But with the one exception being Commodore, which is kind of hilarious, I guess. Tramiel was just a bigger jerk than Bill, and one of them had to give in.
I pulled this out. This is one of my oldest Microsoft things. This is a Fortran 80 for the Apple II in 1980. But so it's got the you know, nice binder and old Microsoft logo.
Futuristic Microsoft font.
I have the original boxed Microsoft Olympic Decathlon for the Apple II with that font on it, and they spelled it with a capital S as well, like in the literature. It was Microsoft. like two words, which makes me chuckle to this day.
Or a prefix and a suffix without anything in the middle.
Yeah, I was always under the impression that Microsoft had written Olympic Decathlon, but I looked it up one day in response to an article that I read about Flight Simulator, because someone had claimed that Flight Simulator was Microsoft's entry into games in like the early 90s. And I was like, ooh, nerd rage, you don't know about Olympic Decathlon. And then I went and looked it up and actually, no, Microsoft just published that. Somebody else wrote it. So I begrudgingly had to stow my nerd rage.
That was interestingly one of the first action games or non-text adventures I had on my Apple IIc, which is my first Apple, and I loved that game. I played it a lot.
I did too. It was actually a lot of fun.
I remember the intro perfectly with the throws the jump, but
And you had to have paddles to play the shot put, which was weird. It was like the only event that you couldn't play on the keyboard. You had a paddle for each joint on your arm. It was. It's very weird.
So not had to great like, with the joystick.
You had to the shoulder. You had to like move the shoulder, and then it would. You'd click, and it would stop, and then like you had to move the elbow, and then click, and then it would throw. It was very strange.
Yeah, well, and it actually looks. You know, like when you're not good at it, you look very weird.
Yeah, never actually played the game, but that sounds like something I'd lose at.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, you could.
Yeah, you could all double joint it if you use that joystick. Like, whoops, that's the other way around.
Excellent. So, yeah, I guess what is that? The Altair and Microsoft, and I guess the other thing that I had on this list is Moss Technology releases the super cheap $25 6502. It looks like it was basically fall 1975. There's some stuff here about a full-page story in July 1975 and the Westcon trade show in September 1975.
Okay, yeah, that must be the one where the infamous candy jar full of CPUs was. That's what the other thing was always talks about.
They had
a candy, literal candy jar full of them that they were selling for $20 a piece or something. Oh yeah, they mentioned it there. Yeah, Woz always tells it that the launch of the 6502 at a trade show was where he got the idea to build the Apple One and Two, because they were so cheap and they were giving them away and whatever.
We'll have plenty of opportunities to talk about things related to the 6502 in the coming years.
Oh yes.
So it seems like 1975 was kind of a setup year.
Putting all the pieces in place for the revolution.
Mm. Okay, let's see. Anything else anyone wanted to say about 1975?
No. So it was sometime back in primary school, so I only vaguely remember it.
Right.
That was the year I was born.
You and the 6502.
You youngins.
I didn't know I was the exact same age as the 6502, actually. It's kind of awesome.
Right.
We've both done well for ourselves.
Okay. So, I guess we can move on from 1975 to the various items of interest and or news we have. Blake, I have you down here for the first one.
Yes, this one, it's a little obscure, I guess. I'm sharing it kind of because I've been tracking it personally for some time. Right now, as of, I guess, about a month ago, the A1222 Plus, codenamed Tabor. It's a newly available model motherboard, actually, of the, I guess, what people are calling the PowerPC, quote, Amigas. Around the same time Apple switched to PowerPC, the Amiga people, despite the Amiga having been discontinued, and Commodore having gone south, started building PowerPC-based accelerators to extend the OS, and now I can't even tell you what the licensing situation is. It's changed so much, but there is something called Amiga OS 4.2 that is an official Amiga OS, and it runs only on several different PowerPC motherboards. This is a unit I've been tracking for, I guess it was announced almost 10 years ago, in 2015, it has it's basically a circuit board, a motherboard you put in a case, mini ATX case, that has a PowerPC CPU that is perhaps surprisingly less powerful than a G3, but more powerful than some of the other consumer-priced boards of this sort. One of the big problems with this is it doesn't have a compatible FPU with any of the prior PowerPCs. It actually uses a bizarrely named Freescale QROLQ P1022, which apparently has a something akin to an SPE. One of the like Sony PlayStation 3, its PowerPC has these kind of dedicated processing modules, and it has one of those instead of a standard FPU, and so there's all this back and forth, and there's a lot of discord about whether this is a good thing or a bad thing. I wanted to note that it actually is on sale, because some were doubting that it ever would be. When it first was announced, I was very interested in acquiring one, and I kind of readied myself. I actually bought a case. It was actually with Michael's assistance, with some Australian footwork, about 9 years ago that I was assisted.
Yeah, I was going to say that looked familiar.
Yes. I was assisted on acquiring this case that someone who was demoing.
Well, it was one of the last ones available, planet wide or something.
Yes. Yes, it was. It was. And I think there was a shipping barrier, indeed. At any rate, this thing is finally available. It took about 10 years to come. And I think there were some parts, limitations. And again, if kind of looking on the, I don't know, anyone that sort of spends time on the Amiga forums, especially since it's become available, we'll see a lot of the back and forth. People are kind of passionate on one side or the other of this thing. I was ready to buy one. I had the case and everything, but it's been so long that I personally have sort of lost interest in going down this road. I actually have a bizarre one of these earlier motherboards, which is a weaker, a lesser power PC on a similar board that you put in the ATX case. And so I do have a system that is, a quote power PC Amiga that can run the latest Amiga OS. And I do it for fun occasionally, but, it's not something that I use weekly. I think the group that put this together, if this had happened earlier, I think I certainly would have bought one. It'll be interesting to see, if anything comes of this. Obviously, it's, you're selling a very custom piece of hardware to a very specific crowd, and that crowd itself is very heated as to whether or not this is a good or bad thing. So it's kind of I don't expect this to, break out and become a new major platform, I'll just say. But anyway, I wanted to mention that it's available. And I don't even, actually now I should probably look at the price.
I'm seeing 1600 euro.
Okay.
For the one in the case. In the case. 1200 euro if you just get the motherboard.
Okay, yeah, that was one of the things I remember when it was being discussed. Part of the point of this, as I understood, and again, I kind of an old school Amiga person. I move loosely in the forum circles. I've been there for decades, but I'm not one. I'm not a person that's right up and to date on the happenings in the latest, the quote current Amiga situation, but. I think the thing people were hoping was that this was going to be a little more affordable. There exists system out there. There's something, a dual processor system like the A5000, which is, or the X5000, I'm sorry, which is a rather powerful system, but I think it costs much, much more than this. I think the thought when it first came out, people were throwing around numbers like, oh, it might be, 600 euro or, 500 euro. I certainly didn't expect it to be that price. I couldn't purchase this even if I was, fairly excited about it at that price. But anyway, I wanted to mention, I think I discussed this loosely once or twice over the years on the show. And if it did launch. So that was in question, I believe, for
how,
some.
How compatible are these things, these modern Amiga things, with original Amigas? That's never been clear to me.
Well, they're completely incompatible with. I mean, they don't have any of the custom hardware of the 68,000 based Amigas. They're not running 68. You know, the PowerPC. They're not 68,000. Just
right,
like the Apple
PowerPC. Right, I get that. But like, can they run the old Amiga software in some form?
That's what there is a built-in. So just from a hardware perspective, I wanted to get that out of the way. There's the standard AUE, the emulators that have been out there for a long time. The Amiga OS 4 has packaged within it, basically emulation layers so that it can run disks. It can boot disk images. It can, desktop applications that play nicely can render and run. And that's, I think, most of them. You know, so you can run old applications and these PowerPCs, the emulate as far as, the CPU and the speed of execution is fine, is quite, quite acceptable. But, for instance, one of these, the board that I happened to go, I think I paid like $600 or $700. I guess it was more than 10 years ago because this is 10 years ago. I guess it was 15, 16 years ago. There was that board. It's a 700 megahertz. It's called a SAM440 EP Flex board. It is not as powerful as the G3. I believe it's not actually as powerful as a PowerPC 604. So it can run things fine, like the applications that you run on it feel good. But, just an interesting example to note, that particular system, which wasn't the slowest or the fastest, certainly not the fastest, but not the slowest out there, it isn't fast enough to, some of the games you might try to run, it actually can't run them at full speed. So, you're limited there. This board, I believe it can, but, it's not a perfect... It's not a perfect fit. I think it, you feel the fact that you're not on, 68,000 hardware. But then again, it's a much more advanced, much more extended and evolved operating system. The interface, the libraries, that kind of thing. And people are writing software for it. There are some browsers for it that, are not as bad as you would think. It would be hard, I think. There are those that will argue with me, but I think it would be hard to do your daily driver, but probably easier so than a 68,000 based Amiga, because it's much more, much more CPU power. But yeah, there's a whole, old school Amiga hardware emulation people, and then there's, the quote new Amiga, the PowerPC Amiga, and that whole situation. And not only this, but there are other some also compatible with the original Amiga DOS operating systems that are modern, such as Morphos and AROS. And these are basically in the modern in the PowerPC faster than the original Amiga hardware scene. There are three competing operating systems, and people are heavily divided among which they want to run. And arguably, some of the other ones, like Morphos, I believe, does a much better job at running original Amiga software, I from what I understand, than the official Amiga OS 4. So it's quite a chaotic scenario. And I've always felt it's a little unfortunate that this tiny group of people are fractured so dramatically, and passionately so. I'll go ahead and say that, I'm poorly representing, I'm sure, the actual, completely accurate state of things, because I'm not that close in. So I'll probably have a number of people hating on me for sticking my big head in here. But I think I gave a pretty good synopsis. And but I just wanted to note for listeners that this board did come out. It's a new. It's the latest, quote Amiga, motherboard, and, there's some fun that could be had with it. I would like to have one, I bought the case for it, but I don't think I could pay $1,100 1200 euro. And it's just, it was more interesting 10 years ago. But I wanted to mention it. So there you go. I'm sure we'll get feedback for that.
Yeah, it definitely does seem like there are just competing aims. You know, like, I guess maybe right. This might be what people who wish the Amiga had made it. And, you know, this is kind of what it would be like now or something. But, you know, yeah. Otherwise it seems like if it's emulating anyway, and you can get, like, you know, faster computers that run emulators for the original Amiga stuff, it does feel like this is, I don't know where this fits in that.
So. Yeah, the implementation sounds basically like Rosetta. You know, every time that Mac had to make an architecture shift, they had Rosetta that would give you an emulation layer so you could run the old stuff while you transitioned and while the developers upgraded the old stuff. But here we've got a situation where the old stuff's never going to get upgraded because it's from 30 years ago. Mm. And so now you've just bought this expensive system that's just going to play all the old stuff really slowly, or run new stuff that's not quite good enough to be actual daily driver productivity software. And I know I'm going to get so much hate mail for this, but yeah, I'm not personally seeing the niche where this fits in, but the hardware is really cool looking and really neat, and clearly a lot of effort has gone into it. So a lot of respect to the communities that have built these things. But yeah, I guess it's a subculture that I am not in, but more power to them if they enjoy it. But
I can make it more complex and put
another. You don't need to. It's okay. We get it.
No, it's interesting that you said, and the other tech is 30 years old. It's not like that's going to get upgraded. Well, it has been. The Amiga OS version 2. Whatever was current. The latest of the 68,000 operating system, the Kickstart ROM, has been extended. And so now there's further development on taking what was done, you know, back in the 80s and early 90s with that 68,000 hardware. There are new ROMs that you can put in the Amiga that I believe are official from the license holder. And so that 30-year-old piece that isn't PowerPC related is now also being extended. And so that camp is getting. Yeah, so it's, that's fairly recent.
Sure. No, yeah, I understand, yeah. Yeah, what I meant, though, was that the point of Rosetta is to buy you time for the application developers to recompile their stuff, which, I mean, if you want an Amiga to play Bitmap Brothers games, those are never going to get updated for Amiga OS 4 or whatever, so that would probably not be the target audience for the a machine like this. If you just want to play the old games, you should probably just get an old Amiga or emulate it on a modern system. But
right. Yeah. One last clarification I'll make is that, yeah, indeed, though, in the context of the, you know, the power, you have a PowerPC system here and you're running, you know, the latest PowerPC based Amiga OS 4.2, it does have its own native, you know, APIs, and it's a known development target. So one can sit down, you know, with C or whatever development tools, write a native PowerPC app that uses the, you know, the most recent, you know, GUI interface elements, the most recent APIs, and release it as an Amiga OS 4 app. And it's not relying at all on any emulation. So that is possible. And that is happening with the apps that are targeting, you know, specifically these new PowerPC systems. So, and those are quite snappy, you know, and the interface elements are nice. It actually looks good and it's snappy, but again, you know, it is sort of a kind of a restricted pool as far as the reach of, you know, what the developer, where they're going to see their app running.
Sold to all 29 people.
No, you can't send the case back.
No, it's still a nice case. I think I was thinking about that. I definitely will use it for something. I got it over there. It's been sitting there for 10 years.
It is a very nice case.
But anyway, yeah. So anyway, that's my news item.
All right. And next, I guess, is Michael. I know something about this as well.
Yeah, so this one is just basically some announcements which Paul's probably very aware of that have just come through the Apple II Facebook group. So as many people are aware now, that Kansas Fest is open for business for registrations, And the theme is my favorite PC, the Apple IIc. So, which is unfortunate that I can't actually attend in person this year. I was planning to, but things have come up to stop that. But what I liked was the two featured speakers that we've got. Rob Gemmell and Rich Williams are going to be there. I gather Rich is going to be in person and Rob is going to be a virtual link, if I remember correctly. But two guys instrumental in the 2C side of things. And for other early Applers, Rich Williams has a very deep run. Basically, project lead for DOS Toolkit, author of FID, author of Muffin, worked with MouseTech 65CO2, and other lovely bits and pieces of the Apple II platform. So if you wanted to go to Kansas Fest, this is a very good year to go, speaker-wise, and also for the theme. As I said, I'm a big Apple IIc fan, and it's very sad from my point of view that I can't make it this year.
Yeah, it's too bad. Yeah, it's the 40th anniversary of the launch of the Apple IIc.
Yeah, unfortunately the launch, which gets overshadowed by that other Apple product that it's never going to catch on. You know, they keep upgrading it every year, the software, they keep upgrading it all the time, and yet the Apple IIc only have one upgrade to the 2C Plus. And that Mac thing, every year they seem to be popping something out, trying to catch up with the Apple IIc and everything that it can do. And I don't know. Apple's fighting a losing battle with that Macintosh platform.
You might be right.
I have to say that I was not aware of Rich Williams' name. It somehow was like stuff that I had, you know, he participated in things that I hadn't dug deeply enough into, but it's amazing, you know. I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but it seems kind of like I'm starstruck to meet the guy who wrote FID, you know?
Yeah, but
it's not that exciting of a program, really.
As you see there on there, he's Apple employee from 79 through to 09. It's really, you're going to have someone turning up who basically was at Apple through all the generations of software and hardware, except maybe, okay, so he won't be involved in the M platform, but all that is just a fast version of what he would have been working on if you look at it that way. But to have been across all of those architectures and to have been so deeply into the software from the Apple II platform's perspective from the 80s. It's, you know, if there was an Apple employee that you wanted to meet apart from Woz, Rich is the man.
Paul, maybe for non-Apple users, do you want to explain what FID is?
That seems fair. It's basically just the program on the System Master, like the DOS 3 System Master that you use to copy files around, and I think you could format disks with it. Manipulates catalogs and files and moves things around. It was, the lore of this is that it was originally called Fishhead. Like he wrote this, and I forget what it stood for. It stood for something, you know, that, you know, file something, you know, handler, but he called it Fishhead, and that was shot down at the executive level. Like they said, we can't make our file utility called Fishhead. It was renamed to FID, which is allegedly Fishhead is dead. they call it something like they officially call it something like file developer, but I think that's a back formation.
And it's notable for Apple II users because if you were an Apple II user at the time, you used FID a lot. Like you spent a lot of your time in that program. So yeah, that's hence the starstruckness, I guess, for us.
Yeah, you look at it, such a small program and what it did, but yes, you were right. We basically lived in it. You didn't do much without it on a development side of things.
Right.
Yeah, and even as a casual user, just like moving files around and like copying stuff from one disk to another, and you know, yeah, just you needed it for everything.
Yeah. No. There was one time where I was I'd taken my Apple IIc into the office and I was just setting things up, and I just swung around from the terminal sessions I'd been using for AX server that I was working with, and promptly tried to copy some files with the on there just using your standard CP, and for some reason it didn't work, and I thought, oh, sorry. Time to reboot with the system master and get FID going.
Right. Yeah. So I think that, I mean, you know, that was a very early contribution, but he also worked with the Apple III and the Twiggy drives and, you know, like, the Newton, he was like software lead on some of the early Newton message pads. And he wrote the digitizer firmware. You know, I mean, so he's wow, deep in this stuff.
Yeah, it's interesting. If you look at his career trajectory, it follows the trajectory that a lot of early programmers did, because you started, of course, with like 6502 or ZAD assembly. But then as the systems got bigger and high-level languages became the norm, a lot of people like him stayed low-level because that was what they enjoyed and that's where their expertise was. So he kind of drifts downward into drivers and then firmware and then, you know, microcode. Like, that's kind of what a lot of folks did, is if you want to stay in 8-bit assembly kind of world, that's what you have to do in modern, as computers advanced. You just had to keep sliding down the stack to stay in that sweet spot zone of 8-bit assembly.
Right.
Yeah, that should be make for some fascinating talks.
Mm. Yeah, and you know, not to downplay Rob Jamil either. He is like he's the 2C guy. You know, he was like the project manager or something. But he designed it. So like, they look the way they do.
You mean the way they look as the most perfect Apple computer ever made? Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So he's got a bunch of like memorabilia and stuff like that that he'll share. So anyway, yeah, interesting. Oh, and the other thing too, which I don't know if this was mentioned, but it's also in Springfield, Illinois. So yeah. If you find yourself in Kansas City in mid July, then you may be in the wrong state.
You've made a wrong turn.
Yeah. I think we joked about this last time, that Kansas Fest is now even less in Kansas.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not even next door anymore.
Yeah, it used to at least be in the city, but now not even that.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. So I am on the committee. So you know, I'm sort of we're working on lots of stuff in there, trying to make this make sense. So.
I'm sure it'll all come together.
Yeah.
As I said, I'm just sort of still grinding the teeth about not being able to attend this year after I was making plans to, and then I hear, you know, it's going to be 2C, and I'm, yay, this is going to be great, and then suddenly other commitments have pulled the rug out from underneath me. But yeah, there's always next year.
Well, and I guess I should probably say, too, that the week... So Kansas Fest is over most of a week, and then a week after it ends, there's a shorter virtual event that will replay the presentations and have you know, unique presentations to the virtual event as well. So that allows you to see things you missed actually there, or participate if you can't get there. So
just won't be there again, for the inaugural one. That's all. So at the new venue. So
yeah.
Did you say it's happening a week later?
Yeah. So the Kansas Fest in person is July 16th through 21st, and then the virtual event is the 27th and 28th. So that's, I think, a Saturday and a Sunday.
Mm-hmm. Boy, this as Micah was saying, I've not been in person yet. This Apple IIc situation is more appealing, I think, than any of the other. Headlining that I've seen since I started, paying attention to it. I was a huge
The Apple
IIc guy.
The Apple III didn't pull you in last year.
It almost pulled me in. It dropped me 4 inches. That's for sure.
Yeah. Right.
But
I'm going to have to drop out. Half the house has lost power, so it looks like someone's got a tree through the power line somewhere. I've lost a phase on the house, so basically the rest could go at any time. So sorry that my return is somewhat short. I'm going to go and get the generator ready because invariably I think I'm about to lose all the power to the house. Okay, see you.
Good luck.
Bye, everybody.
Good luck.
Good luck. Okay, let's see. So I guess the next thing is my thing. This is not super new as we're recording, but we hadn't recorded since this happened. But it caused a bit of discussion. Zilog announced that they are stopping the production of the Z80, the Z80. So there's a last time to buy set of June 14th, 2024, at which point they will stop making them. So this caused much consternation because it's a very useful and well used platform. I think so. I'm nearing the end of my expertise on this, but from what I understand, it's no longer going to be possible to buy this form factor, the 40-pin dip Z80, and I think a couple of others. I think there is some form of chip that will live on, but anyway, Quinn, you probably know more about this.
Yeah, I read a little bit into this. So as you said, they're basically killing the standalone CPU in the DIP package and probably the couple of the surface mount packages as well. But it's kind of, it got a lot of press, but it's kind of more of a I didn't know they were still making those story than it is an oh my gosh, they're killing it story. It's like the 6502 still exists, but they haven't made the actual, dips that you can buy standalone for decades, for a very long time. What Western Design Center now sells is you can buy cores, you can buy FPGA, you can buy microcontrollers that are based on a 6502 core, so you can buy 6502 cousins and found, based things, but the actual, 40-pin dips have been gone for a long time as well. So the fact that they were still making this Z80 40-pin dip is sort of amazing. The ones that are going to live on, the Z180, which is like the 65816 to the Z80, if you will, is still being made. And of course, they'll still sell you a core for your FPGA, which is how most things would be using it anyway. Like if you want to build a controller for a washing machine or something, that kind of application, a Z80 is still a good choice for that. But you wouldn't use a standalone chip CPU for that. You would use it as part of an embedded microcontroller or system on chip or ASIC or FPGA, all of which Zilog will still sell you the core for that. So it's not really going away. It's just like the one package that nobody was buying anyway is going away.
I feel like you would be the one to answer this amongst us, Quinn, but just like with the 6502, the Z80 here, with the SoCs, the cousins, how some of the more simplistic ones, some of the ones that are more, where the core is more exposed, so to speak, how hard would it be to adapt that to work as if it were a standalone unit? Have you seen situations where there's, interfaces that do that, or would it just be, you know what I mean?
Yeah, if you wanted to do that, probably the easiest way is an FPGA, where you can certainly configure an FPGA to act as a standalone Z80 or 6502. Absolutely. It's a bit like, you would be using so little of the FPGA to do that. It's a bit like when we build retro computers, we put, a 1 megabyte RAM chip in them because that's the smallest one you can buy, and then use the bottom 64K of it. It'd be like that. But yeah, you can certainly do that.
Okay.
Yeah. Typically, what you do with an FPGA for something like an embedded application is you have a whole bunch of control circuitry for an industrial factory production line or something, and inside there is a 6502 running it. So the software is written in 6502 assembly to run that box conveyor belt or whatever, and then the rest of the FPGA is used for the control circuitry that's needed for that device. So you can just not do all of that stuff and just have the 6502 in there and then just connect all the pins to the FPGA's pins and then build an adapter and stick it in your 65 and stick it in your Apple II and it would work. Yeah, it'd be a lot of effort I'm not sure why anyone would ever do that, because you can still buy 6502s on eBay and stuff. There's lots of them around. I mean, they made tens of millions of them, so there's plenty of them around if you want to buy one. Like when I made my homebrew machine, I had no trouble buying 6502s. I've got five of them in a drawer.
Sure. Yeah, it's interesting. I got a taste of that with, or I guess as far as the SoCs versus standalones for Motorola, you know, 68000s and the like. The person behind Individual Computers, as I recall, I think Jens Schoenfeld, at any rate, he was working on something and was looking for some kind of a, you know, pre-existing SoCs that had a 68000 core to use it only for the 68000 because of some limitation that he'd run into in acquiring, you know, whatever devices. And he did a search and found, you know, there's a number of devices. And one of them was this SCSI card. And in one of the web searches he did for it was a picture of the scene behind me, which is my wall of computers. And I have some interface cards decoratively hung above my head. One of them was that SCSI card. And he saw the card and sent me a zoomed in picture and circled the chip and said, would you mind reading the very precise numbers on the 68000 base system here? I'm trying to possibly source it. To see if this is, I can get some inexpensive pools of these things and just to use the core. And we went back and forth. It did not actually work out for him. But yeah, that was interesting. That's what he was trying to do. So
yeah, if someone's trying to make a product, that's a very different conversation, because while yes, you can easily burn a 68000 core onto an FPGA and use it, it would be expensive. FPGAs are not cheap. Sure. So, I mean, they're cheap for a hobbyist if you just need one. But if you're trying to make 10,000 of a product, your unit cost on them is probably going to be $20 or something like that, which is pretty high for a unit price on any component for a product that you're trying to manufacture. So that's that's a very different conversation. What you would end up doing probably in that case is using a modern microcontroller, like something ARM-based, and just emulating the 68000. Like that would be way easier than trying to find some kind of core or system-on-chip application or trying to get like epoxy dies or something of a 68000. Like it's just way easier to emulate it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think the Jens and Individual was basically, you know, modern retro enhancement products, you know, flicker fixers, the Cat Weasel drive adapters, that kind of thing. So I wouldn't get too carried away as far as the scope of sales for what he was going for. But I gotcha. Yeah. So
If you just need 20 of them, then right. Yeah, maybe like finding them on old SCSI controllers is a viable approach. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I could see that. Yeah, like people did that with the SIDS for a while. People were making 8-bit synthesizers that sold in small unit counts, like 100 or so, to niche, you know, electronic musicians. And yeah, they were just harvesting them out of C64s, unfortunately for the hobby. But yeah, that's where they were getting them. So there was a period there in the 2000s on eBay where there was a whole lot of Commodore 64s for sale with no SIDs in them, which was pretty frustrating.
All right. So let's see. I guess the next thing is Quinn's.
So we've been joking lately about how every time we do this show now, I learn about some new computer that I'd never heard of, and it is that portion of the show. This came across one of my mainstream feeds, actually non-computer feeds in my RSS reader, which is always interesting when that happens. So this is the Sega AI, which is a very niche computer that I had never heard of that existed very briefly in 1986. And it's so niche, it's extremely rare. There's something like less than 10 of these things known to exist. It was on the market for a very brief time, and it's shockingly powerful, which is kind of how it caught my eye. I mean, obviously, something that came out around that time that we've never heard of is always going to catch my eye. But then you look at the specs on this thing. It's got a 16-bit NEC V20 CPU, which I actually had to look up. So the NEC V20 is a 16-bit CPU that is pin compatible and object code compatible with the 8088. So it could, in principle, run XT software, which is kind of amazing. And it's, in principle, a drop-in replacement for the Intel chip. Now, that doesn't mean you can run XT software on the Sega AI computer, of course, because it doesn't have the BIOS and the, you know, the architecture of a PC. But so it has this, but it has this 16-bit CPU in it, so impressive CPU. It's got 128K of ROM. It's got a speech synthesizer. The video chip is very impressive. It's the Yamaha V9938, which is the sequel to the, what is it, 9918A, that chip that's in the TI-99s, and it's in the ColecoVision, and it's in a bunch of arcade machines. So that was already a very good video chip, and this Yamaha sequel to that chip is extremely powerful and showed up in very few places. I think maybe the MSX2 had had that chip as well. I'm not sure. But it's also got multiple sound chips in it for both synthesis and FM music, so and various other things. Amusingly, the media for it is cassette only, so that was a strangely backward thing to do in 1986. But yeah, as far as I can tell, this thing never made it out of Japan, so there was a handful of them were sold in Japan, and then it vanished. And the name is interesting. So it's called the Sega AI computer. The AI comes from, it had some sort of built-in Prolog interpreter. And from what I've read about it, that thing was, it was not accessible to, applications. So if you were writing a game or an app for this thing, you couldn't access that. So it's not really clear what this built-in Prolog interpreter was for. But for anyone who doesn't know, Prolog was an early artificial intelligence targeted language, kind of like Lisp. It was supposed to make AI type applications easier. So this thing has sort of, it's software, it's not a hardware acceleration of Prolog, but it's, yeah, it has this built-in Prolog interpreter, and it's not exactly clear what it's for. So what this system ended up doing, it was kind of targeted at schools, so it had a very brief life as an edutainment kind of machine, kind of like the Apple IIs did in North America, where they were hoping schools would all have these things. There was a lot of like math blasters and Reader Rabbit type applications made for this thing. But it had some very cool peripherals, like it had a touchpad and a built-in cassette drive. It had a jog wheel on the side of it. Like, you got to see the pictures of this thing, which we'll link to in the show notes, because it's a very strange looking thing. It's out of time, this thing. It looks like someone reached forward into some early Apple product line and pulled this thing back and put a cassette drive on it. It's very strange. But there's also some screenshots in this link that I'm going to have in the show notes of some of the software, so you can see how impressive the graphics actually are. That Yamaha V9938 chip is very impressive. But there was only, I think, less than 6 applications or maybe 10 written for this thing. Yeah, they have screenshots here of literally every piece of software that was written for it, which is less than a dozen, I think. And basically all educational and all in Japanese. But this is 1986, is pretty early for something as seemingly technically impressive as this machine is, when you consider that it would have been out at the same time as, you know, something like the Apple IIgs or the black and white Macs, which were certainly less powerful than this thing appears to be. It's a strange thing, and I'm giving it as a news item because there's been some recent updates to it. So the story kind of started in January of this year. Basically, this guy found one who wrote this. So the page I'm going to share in the show notes is a massive write-up on this machine and everything that's currently known about it. You know how every so often you find a web page that's like some very specific nerdy deep dive on one very specific thing? Well, that's this page about the Sega AI computer. So this guy has like made himself the world expert on this machine that nobody seems to know anything about it. So he found one and then went deep on it. And it is emulated in MAME, because of course it is. I don't know how MAME managed to get one to emulate, but he did, or they did. And then he's had a couple of updates since. So the most recent update is in I think March or May of this year, depending how you read that date, he found a couple of the remaining applications for it. So he's trying to accumulate all of the software for it as well. But yeah, really interesting machine, and one that I'd certainly never heard of. And it's every so often there's a computer that looks like it's from a parallel universe, like some alternate 80s computer revolution that happened on another planet, and this is one of those machines. That's why I'm fascinated by this thing. So that's it, the Sega AI computer.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it. That's an amazing looking thing, yeah.
Yeah, it's a strange beast. I mean, the screenshot I've got on the stream right now, where you can see the keyboard, it's got a regular mechanical keyboard, but then there's this whole great big touchpad in the center of the machine as well that maybe has overlays, because there's other pictures of it that don't have all of the graphics on the touchpad. So I think it has like Intellivision style overlays.
Must be.
Yeah, and for different educational applications, presumably, and. The hardware, the architecture of it is, from what this guy has dug into, the architecture is very much a combination of the Sega Master System and the Genesis. So it has a very console-like architecture in it, and as you would expect to come from Sega. But just the fact that Sega made a computer in the first place was news to me. And then the fact that this thing existed at all and that it had a bunch of software is super interesting. I mean, there were... You know, as we know, there were other console companies that were trying to break into computing. Of course, we have the Atom and some of those attempts, but there were the Intellivision also had a brief attempt to make a computer. They had a basic and a keyboard attachment that you could buy for your Intellivision that would sort of turn it into the world's worst computer. But this thing was a ground-up effort to build a computer by a console company. They were not trying to create cheesy add-ons that no one was going to buy. This was a dedicated effort and specifically targeting educational software, which was also interesting. So very interesting project. I don't know how it came to exist, and it went away very fast, and it's got to be one of the rarest computers out there, I think.
Yeah, that's cool. That's fascinating, and you, I hear you about that graphics chip. Yeah, I think that one I followed with some degree of closeness. We may have discussed an aftermarket upgrade. Well, it's like a replacement system for the TI-99/4A, the Geneve 9640, which basically took over the peripheral box and, you know, became the TI. It had one of those, 512 color palette, you know, higher resolution. I think it even supported interlace. And I believe you're right. I think MSX2, had it, but I don't know how heavily it was utilized. Those screenshots on this page are quite colorful. It looks impressive. That was nice chip.
Yeah, the graphics on this thing are great. It's really, really, really nice for 1986, especially. I think all the specs and stuff are in here for it. I don't have them at the top of my head, but it had really great music, and it had built-in speech synthesis as well. Like, yeah, this thing had a lot of hardware in it, and a lot of very specialized hardware, maybe that's what killed it. It must have been expensive for all of that hardware. I mean, it had 512K of ROM in it, and the speech synthesizer, and 120K of RAM, and a 16-bit CPU, and, you know, that, and this Prolog thing, and then all the custom hardware, the jog wheel and the touchpad. I mean, all of that is expensive. All of that's going to add to the unit cost of this machine. And so if I had to guess about what killed it, surely cost. I mean, if you think like an Apple II Plus, in 1982 was something like $3,500. In 86, this thing must have been like $5,000 or $6,000. Like, it must have been crazy expensive, which might be what doomed it, but who knows? So.
Yeah. Well, and it had Prolog. That's the most bizarre thing.
Came so far out of left field. Yeah, I don't know. Some middle manager decided to put Prolog in this thing, and you're like, what? It's not at all clear what it's there for, but that's where it gets the AI in Sega AI computer from. Yeah, I guess they were looking for something to distinguish it, I guess, in the marketplace, maybe. Yeah, they needed a hook, yeah.
I guess. That's,
well, Prolog's a little bit related to Logo too, right? I mean, aren't Logo and Lisp and Prolog all sort of related?
I think so. I mean, all of those, they're all academic languages, at least, which are all Logo sort of related. Logo, I think, is more directly related to, is it TCL? I forget.
There was something called Scheme too, I think.
Yeah, that might be what I'm thinking of. Anyway, yeah, there's a complicated family tree of those academic languages for sure, but... And I mean, Prolog, I mean, I'm throwing shade for fun, but Prolog was a serious language earlier. Like, 86 is kind of late for it, I think, but in the 70s, Prolog was a pretty serious AI research language. But to have it in a consumer product in 86 is pretty wild. That's kind of out of left
field. From Sega.
Yeah, from Sega, yeah. Yeah, yeah. There must have been someone on the development team who was like a, you know, academic computer scientist, and he liked it or something. Who knows?
There is one thing that, so Rembrandt in our comments pointed out one aspect of this, which is pretty amusing. If you look at the keyboard, it's connected by a wire, you know, because it's yeah. as it would be. But they've decided to put the wire coming out the front.
Right. Yeah, that's right. That is very strange.
So yeah. Rembrandt had said, if you told me this had been AI generated, I'd believe it.
Yeah, because that's the kind of thing that an AI would get wrong. Yeah. I think the reason for that is because the keyboard will sit on top of the touchpad and just kind of cover it, in which case it makes some amount of sense to have the cable coming out the front, because when you have it on sitting on top, then you've got a little loop. I don't know. That's my guess as to why they did that. But yeah, that is strange.
It is.
Yeah. This thing has all the hallmarks of an engineering skunkworks project. Like when someone at Sega was like, we need a next generation crazy, you know, shoot for the stars kind of thing. So let's take 20 engineers and lock them in a room. And when you don't sufficiently supervise your engineers, you get things like this, where, yeah, they just threw in every crazy idea and you end up with something that costs $1 million and is useless, but is technically fascinating.
Yeah. The best kind of fascinating.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let's see. Are there more things? Oh yeah. Let's see. Actually, there was one more thing that I thought would be probably a good thing to mention, since it does come up, or it has come up, is that BASIC turned 60. So I think that is, it might have been, you know, I'm not sure what the actual date is supposed to be. Yeah, May 1st, 1964 was when the first program was run at Dartmouth or whatever. So this, you know, people have been talking about this a bit in recent memory, because we're recording on May 12th. Who knows when you'll hear it on the feed, but so yeah, we'll link to an article by Benj Edwards that sort of goes over some of this, but there's plenty of sort of documentation on this, and we probably don't need to go through the story. I think we did, actually. I feel like maybe it was like 5 years ago or something, but there was a basic milestone that we did talk through.
Yeah, we covered it pretty heavily on the show fairly recently.
Not relatedly, but same, I guess, ballpark of things. I think it was Pascal that turned 40 a few shows ago. I think we talked about that as well.
Yeah,
I think we went deep on BASIC in episode 264, because that was the 64-year show.
That might have made sense.
Actually, I think it was Turbo Pascal turned 40, but Pascal later turned 50. It was a different decade jump, sorry. But yes, it also hit a round number.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess we can leave that there and turn to a word from our sponsor.
Look what the computer wizards at Apple have come up with now. It has the power of these two computers, a built-in disk drive. It can run over 10,000 different programs. You get everything you need to hook it right up to your TV. You can even add a mouse. Introducing the Apple IIc. Now comes the real magic. You can take it home for under $1,300. Introducing the Eye-Opener, the simple way to access the internet and email from a company called NetPliants.
And we're back. So the host retro computing gift idea for this time is a 40-pin dip Zilog Z80. So time is limited if you want to get this retro computing enthusiast friends.
That's awesome. So for those not on the stream, the link on the screen here is a link to it on Mouser. So you can still go right now and buy it, but it's been marked end of life. So whatever stock they have, of course, they're going to sell, and that'll be it. but you can still currently buy it in units of one for $9.72, which is pretty awesome. Or if you want 1,000 of them, you can get them for $5.52.
Yep.
Indeed, the notifications right here says on the website, scheduled for obsolescence. So, yes.
Very, very elegantly phrased.
Yeah. Indeed.
Oh, and Mouser has 1,171 still in stock. So if you want the remaining Z80 inventory, this would be a good place to start, probably.
If you want to be really mean, you could just buy that lot of 1,000.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You could be the Sun remarketing of 40-pin Zilog.
Yeah. All right. Well, so when you are done buying out Mouser's Z80 inventory, we can turn our attention to eBay. And Blake, I think you have the first of these auctions.
Okay. Yes, I was just, this kind of fits into a conversation we were, something Quinn was saying a little bit earlier. I noticed there is it's new to me. I think it's fairly new to the scene. It's an item, the listing is for the Backsid 6581, 8580, Commodore 64. It's an emulated SID, basically. It's a microcontroller that is emulating, it looks like, both the old and new SID, the 6581 and the 8580. So if you have one of the Commodore 64s that was stripped of its SID for music synthesizer use, you could theoretically add this and be back in business. There are a number of such devices I've noticed out there. The ad listing here is from the manufacturer of this device, and they list a couple of perks it has over competitors. I don't have a particular fondness or connection to this one in particular, but it's nice to see inexpensive microcontroller based things that are kind of the heart and soul of some of the retro machines out there, the SID chip and the Commodore 64 being one of them. It's nice to see that replacements are there that are modern, can be continued, and keep getting, I guess, more accurate and more accurate as far as the in this case, the punchy sound and all of the little traits and quirks are apparently better represented than ever. So it's $29.99 each, $30 for this replacement unit. And it looks like they're selling. They've got 10 available at the moment. But again, this is the creator. Just to mention this as an example of another piece of modern tech kind of filling a gap, or filling a socket. So there you go.
I think it's neat. Like, so if for anyone who hasn't seen it, it's a little PCB with the same pin out, like the same pin footprint as a real SID, but sitting in the middle of it is just a tiny little ARM microcontroller. That's pretty cool. And I guess for anyone who doesn't know, the SID is notoriously difficult to recreate, hence it requiring an entire modern ARM microcontroller to even make an attempt at it. It had analog components on the die. So any emulation of it is always going to be an approximation, and different approximations of it are better or worse. And in fact, people say that the SIDs were all a little bit different as well, because there was small differences in manufacturing that made the analog components of the die sound different. But I'm sure something like this is more than sufficient for anyone who's not super deep into Commodore stuff. I'm sure it sounds just fine.
I think the challenge here has to be, I think as the years went on, people learned like this little glitchy quirk of the SID combined with this little glitchy quirk. If you do this, if you hit these two glitches in the same way, it actually will produce this new sound. And so that's something that, you can, with some reliability, do with the actual chips. And I guess the people behind these are probably looking for, are these two things happening? Let's try to emulate that as well. I always wanted a SID, I understand, it has some analog components and it has a very distinct sound. I always wanted, I think there at one point it existed in some form for a PC. I wanted it for the Mac, like an external box, a USB box with an actual SID chip and an audio output so that I could, play SID tracks, legit, realistically through my, on the Mac or something. what I learned in, you know, digging in the forums, why is this not happening, you know, is apparently the 6502, just it was such a synchronicity between the SID and the 6502 as far, or the 6510, as far as how they, you know, how it drives the SID. It's more than just, and I didn't get a full understanding of the details here, but it's more than just, okay, here's a general computer, we'll feed it the data. It's almost as if there's a deeper connection. I don't know. From what I understand, it's almost that you need a 6502 to make it, happen. And it could be that the microcontroller is actually, you know, that's in the scope of what's being emulated here, you know, is the processing setup as well. So, yeah, it's a really crazy, but obviously very nice sounding piece of hardware. So anyway, that caught my interest.
Yeah, interesting. I mean, that's what I think of when I think of SID chip is unemulatable. But
yeah, apparently it is. I mean, that's what they used to say, and now we're getting close, I guess. But it's a hard thing.
Yeah, it'll always be an approximation unless somebody finds the original Ruby lith for the original die and, you know, produces new ones with those analog elements on the die. It's always going to be an approximation. But, I mean, we can almost certainly today get it emulated to a point where nobody could tell the difference in a blind listening test. People will claim they can tell, but if you blinded them, I bet they couldn't. Or
well, they'd be worrying about what you just done to them so severely that they'd say, yes, it sounds the same. I promise you. What are you going to do to me next? For the love of God.
Blinding in the scientific sense, not in the mob sense. Yeah.
So that's a SID and that's Coke. That's not a SID and that's Pepsi.
Yeah, much like wine tasting, I think SID appreciation is probably 80% nonsense. But yeah, don't at me, wine nerds. I've read the studies.
All right, let's see. I think I am next here, and I have maybe not found as many things as I often do. But so here's a random list of things. One thing that I was surprised to see, just because I hadn't seen it before, was a map pack by Penguin for the Apple. So this is, it's basically like sort of map clip art. You know, it comes with all the states. Yeah, this never came across my field of vision in the days that when it was actually sold. And I was just surprised to find another sort of Penguin title that I hadn't seen before.
I wonder what format the artwork would be in for this, because like graphic formats weren't very standard at this time. So unless it was specific to like print shop or newsroom or Geos or something like that, like what format are these in? Is this graphics magician, these things?
I think you can use them in Complete Graphics System is the Penguin product that would okay. do this.
Okay, so it's a clip art pack for that software.
I believe that is correct, yeah.
Okay.
I'm not probably going to seek this out too much, but it's interesting that it existed. So you can all 50 states in the U.S., Canadian provinces and continents filled in and outline. So
it's just nice to be mentioned.
Yeah,
that's sure. Right. Like, never saw this one before.
Somewhere there is a relatively funny, you know, brief Onion article about like Perky Canada has own customs laws.
Yeah, exactly.
Article.
This one city marked on their map that says Canada City.
Yeah.
That's so good.
Yeah, from 1996, this was. Wow. So it's a time when I was paying attention to the Onion.
Yeah. Still funny, though, today, actually. So that's the Onion for you. Your comedy holds up.
Okay, let's see. What was the next thing? Oh, yeah. I'm not sure that I would necessarily recommend this, but this is the Lode Runner board game.
Oh my. Yes, we played this at Kansas Fest one year and it is not good. But it is fascinating that it exists, but as a game it is not good.
I feel like I remember it being discussed. It was not an entertaining game, right? Or nope. Not really a fun game.
Okay. No, not at all.
Yeah. But it's rare. So so if you want to, you can buy it for $417.
It did have one neat element, which is that your character pieces, so you could carry the gold around, and the little gold containers were like little plastic they looked like oil drums in the version that we had, and they would actually sit on your character. So when you were carrying them around, it was actually like, so it's a production level that would be considered common in modern board games. But at this time, board game production values were much, much lower. So it was very much just like you would have expected, just paper chits for everything. But they had actual little plastic elements that, you know, connected together to form your character. So that was kind of neat. But that's the only, I would say, interesting property about this, aside from being branded Lode Runner.
Yeah. Part of what made me go and look for this was that if you are a super fan of the game, you can get a fridge magnet of the box cover. I don't know why someone decided that this was a good idea.
Wow, but, so it's a promotional magnet of the cover of the board game of the video game.
Yeah, wow. Exactly.
All right. I look forward to the movie adaptation of this magnet.
That's right. How does it work? But, yeah. Anyway, I don't think this is a vintage item. I think this is a modern magnet.
Oh, okay.
But,
all right. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Also comes with a 20-page staple together prologue primer.
Hopefully, yeah.
It's an AI magnet. Yeah.
If you wanted to get the 1975 MITS Altair Users Group Computer Notes Magazine, Volume 1, Issue 1, that says Altair Basic Up and Running, you can get that for $500 on eBay. But it seems like it connected well with the discussion from what seems like a million years ago of the Altair 8080, or 8800, I mean.
It's sort of funny that the earliest computer documentation is the most expensive, as you would sort of expect, but the earliest computer documentation was also the worst produced, because at the time, these were very small companies or single hobbyists who didn't have access to printing presses and things, so everything is like badly photocopied stuff they wrote on their typewriter or did manual paste up in their on their kitchen table. So now it's just the worst produced material, but now it's worth the most money.
Yeah. Let's see. I picked the a reproduction of the U.S. patent, or at least some of the illustrations of the patent for the Apple IIc, so you can sort of see what they thought it was going to look like.
I didn't know even back then Apple was just patenting everything they did, just in case.
Yeah.
I don't think I realized they had patented the Apple IIc.
Oh, that's funny. You have Blake has a.
Oh, he's got a copy of it.
Physical. Yeah.
Right. Oh, that's neat. Yeah, the actual patent, according to what it said there, is for the housing. The personal computer housing is what they patented. So the plastic shell, basically, is what they're claiming to have patented here.
Excellent. It's nice that Blake had the this patent stuff right on hand, just off camera.
Yeah, exactly.
I acquired this on eBay some time ago. I had no memory whatsoever of it, but in the cleaning of my moist basement room, I came across a manila folder with this in it, and I thought, oh, I must have somehow purchased this and put it on the shelf just 2 days ago. So it was waiting for me. It's almost a providence that prepared me for this recording.
Also, I would point out that it listed as first inventor here is Rob Jamel.
So there you go. Look at that.
Who will be coming to talk virtually at Kansas Fest.
Should ask him if he ever got any royalties for this patent.
Just to get the tensions high.
Yeah.
Get him fired up.
So did anyone ever license that patent from you for the Apple IIc case? Anyone ever try to make a PC that looked exactly like this?
You know, one of the things that it would be kind of neat is to have some of these people who used to work together interact, now, so we will have Rob Jamel, beaming in, when our in-person speaker is there, and I'm hoping that they didn't just like hate each other, but.
You never know, I guess.
About that food in the fridge.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Turns out one of them was the guy that ate the other one's lunch every day.
Right. Okay. Now, I guess this is the last thing I was going to put up. So I don't have much to say about this exactly, but this is a NetPliance eye opener in its box. This is, I think, maybe a slightly later. I don't know. It's called an eye opener 2001. So it might be a slightly later version of the eye opener NetPliance. But so we had in our sort of like, you know, whatever private chat, we had been talking a little bit about these devices, and you can still get them, and it's kind of like a dedicated internet appliance, as NetPliance might suggest. So you can browse the web and check your email, you know, in the kitchen, without having to use a command line or know anything about computers, I guess. I think it was also a subscription thing too. So I saw some reference to that somewhere. So you subscribed to their service, and so that you could get your email through it. I guess it's maybe like a like as if there were like an AOL terminal.
I actually had one of these and hacked it. Like it was interestingly, the story was that they sold it for like $99, and you know, it had a Winchip CPU in it. You know, it was a decent little PC, but it had QNX operating system or something on it, and you would dial into their service and use it. They didn't have a binding contract initially, so you could buy it and never sign up and pay the monthly fee of like $25 a month or something. That was the case for about a month. And it got out, and everyone jumped on it, and I grabbed one. And so I got the unit. I installed Windows on it. I think it was Windows 98 or something like that. And did a number of hardware upgrades to it. I think I had it as a little temporary desktop computer while I was between Macs. I was selling one of my Power Macs for another. And I used it as my main machine for like 2 months. And did a number of upgrades. Like you had the ability to put in a hard drive, which it didn't have. You could upgrade the CPU, add a serial. People started like weeks after it was released. Someone sold a breakout serial board specifically for this unit, so you could give it serial ports. And so it was a great little computer. And then after about a month, learned their mistake, and they started. You know, they made the contract binding. You're purchasing it. You know, you then agreed to pay this for like 2 years. The hard disk interface, they pulled the pins off and covered it with a massive block of glue so that no one, if you opened it up and tried to go in, they put a number of glue blocks to prevent you from physically, you know, adjusting it. And one day I was driving to work, and I got a phone call from iOpener Company. And they said, we need to talk to you because we notice you haven't registered your iOpener. I was like, oh yes, I don't intend to do that. That's not part of the agreement, terms of service. And she's like, oh, it is. And I said, no, I said, I've been following it closely. I said, I've got Windows installed. I upgraded the CPU, the RAM. It's a nice little machine. This is driving in the morning to work on the cell phone. And she says, you know, she's with her, and she says, well, we've retroactively changed our terms of agreement. And she said, so it is actually required for you to pay it, or you'll have to pay this amount. I was like, ah, that's interesting. I can discuss it with my wife, who is an attorney. I believe that retroactively changing the terms of service after a purchase is not something that's going to fly very well. But,
yeah, good luck with that one in back, court. Yeah.
Yeah. So she actually called me back later in the day and said, so what have you done with your IO? I said, oh, well, I mean, I stripped the case off and I've mounted it in a frame, which I wanted to indicate I defaced it. She said, all right, just keep it. Don't worry about it. I was like, oh, I was never worried.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not the one who was worried.
So they were literally calling around, like they were calling everyone that they entered their phone number, I guess, to order, trying to get them to sign this terms of service, which, I mean, I feel bad for them, but it seems like they're lawyers. I mean, how do you send something dependent on, you know, the profit from, you know, it's a loss. They sold it at a loss, obviously, and then don't make it binding. So, yeah, it was for about 2 months. It was a huge party, though all of us that got it were having. There was like dedicated forums, and I got a sticker on it that says "I opened," like it's sitting on the sticker. I bought it custom. I mean, it was a great time, but yeah. So anyway, I'm sorry to override your item, but I did have some history there to share. That was a fun time, I'll have to say. I did enjoy fully that. And then finally, I sold the expanded thing on eBay when I was done with it. So,
huh. Yeah,
but
that's like that is a fascinating little supernova subculture that appeared and then vanished in the space of like 30 days around this machine. That's actually pretty interesting. Mm-hmm. I had no idea about any of that.
Yeah, I remember like buying the I opened sticker. There were some other that were far more in your face and visceral, you know. It was just people were pissed, you know, and they were ready to, you know, like, so I remember some guy had a long heat sink sticking out the back of the unit. He had put some incredibly powered CPU, and some guy was like, it was his, like, he had a server farm of these things or something. It was nuts. Boy, what a time to be alive that was.
How desperate they must have been, though, to try and call people and hope they could bully them into sending money, as though they could retroactively change the terms of a signed contract. Like, that is like no lawyer would not laugh you out of the room on that one.
Hmm.
They were just hoping people didn't know any better, I'm sure. It would just be like, oh, okay, and send them money.
Right.
They must have seen that they clearly were absolutely going to go under, and they were just doing a lot.
Yeah, it must have been an existential situation for the company, or they wouldn't have tried that, I'm sure.
I mean, we shouldn't have been able to, you know, I mean, it was their mistake. We shouldn't have been able to do it. It was fun, but I guess I do kind of feel bad for them. But that call was a little annoying.
This is probably related then. I did actually come across the iOpenor BIOS. So that's like something if yours, I think this allows you to use a hard drive. So it's probably some part of that same project.
Oh, and there was one guy that had a tattoo, like it was one of these eye opener related tattoos on his. He had a picture of it. It was newly inked. It was all red, and it was like some, you know, hardcore eye opener thing. Yeah, I don't know. That's funny. Yeah, I guess they changed. Obviously, they would have changed the ROM, right? So, yeah.
All right. Okay, I think we made it through the eBay items. So I guess we can maybe turn to closing discussions and any notes you may have. Blake, you are first.
All right. I guess I'm just going to continue, setting up the computer room. Everything is, at one point there was this crowded room, which people have, seen pictures and have watched me sit in doing the podcast. It was completely empty. Nothing was there. And so I'm slowly putting things back. I've made some decisions, put some additional units on the shelf. I'm not using I don't really use the TRS-80 Model 4 daily, so I gave up some desk space for that and kind of put it in more of a display thing. Anyway, so I made some different choices. I'm setting it back up, and that'll probably go for another week or so before I'm fully back. And our dining room is thankfully fully without stacks of vintage computing hardware, literature, and such. Yes, my wife and daughter have not enjoyed the intrusion into the main area of the house with all of my dusty things that smell old, as my daughter indicates.
Are you sure she wasn't talking about you?
No, that's a separate old smell, and apparently I do smell old, but this is a different, dustier smell. I'm not as dusty. I do tend to keep myself rather dusted off, but yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's I continue to strive to do that. And again, everyone, please change your sump pump about every 5 to 6 years. I recommend.
Full circle.
Only costs about $250-$300, but you know it's worth avoiding a very, very unpleasant life experience. So.
Let's see. For closing notes for me, I don't really have much to say. I mean, I guess it's just work's been very busy. And for people who are somehow managing to follow along in real time, the episodes that you can hear on the feed are way behind the episodes that we are recording. Someday soon that will hopefully change. But whenever I have free time, I tend to edit rather than like play around with old computers. But that too, I hope will change. So Quinn, any closing notes for you?
So I've been extremely busy with a new retro project, but I'm not able to talk about it yet. So we've talked about it here on the show in the Discord, but I'm pretty close to being able to announce it, actually, because progress has been good. But yeah, I've been working really hard on something that I think is really cool. Maybe next time we record, I'll have that announced. So I basically got one more bug to fix in this thing that I'm doing. So assuming I get that done in the next whatever, however many weeks it is till we record again, maybe I'll be able to announce it next time. But I'm so close. It's very exciting.
Excellent. So, yeah.
Stay tuned.
Very cool. Very cool. Cliffhanger.
Yeah, I feel like I kind of want to come up with a good project just because the Kansas Fest, you know, submission deadline is coming up, and I feel like I ought to submit something.
Maybe I should submit a talk about this thing I'm doing. I haven't done KFest talk in a long time. Might be due for one.
All right. So, well, I guess that is it for this show. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can find lo-fi episodes and more at Gopher, also at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss the show in the forums at forum.vcfed.org/something. You can follow RCR on Mastodon. We are at RCR Podcast at podcasts.social. You can join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. And I meant to ask Michael, actually, if he's taking care of the Facebook group. I think he is, but his electricity went out. So there is activity there. And I think, you know, if you aren't let in, then get a hold of us in some other way, and we'll, you know, find someone to moderate that group. But you can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are members of the Throwback Network at throwbackreviews.com, and please write a review on iTunes, which we are now back on, if you want. And until next time,
Retro Compute.